I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to dive into some reporting by the Side Effects public media team and discuss the challenges addicted mothers face. We're going to talk about problems and try to find solutions. My guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health, Dr. Pat Clements, also of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the problems that addicted mothers face. We're surfing, actually, on some very fine reporting that the Side Effects public media team has done. If you want to join this important conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health. She'll be joining us shortly. Dr. Pat Clements, also of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, who is Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. To be here.
It's good to have you both here. So I think probably to set this up, Emily Foreman of the Side Effects public media team has done a story that sort of lays out what at least one of the challenges is facing these mothers. I think probably it would be wise for us to listen to that first, and then we can talk about the scope of this problem and how we are dealing with it. We'll listen to Emily Foreman's fine reporting now.
Like this patient, I made 1, 2, 3 calls.
Nurse Biz Grimes keeps what she refers to as a log of Medicaid messes and nightmares.
And that was a total of 70 minutes.
According to her note, she easily spends over 20 hours a week calling pharmacy directors and insurance plan supervisors.
It's like, okay, this has become a battle, and I'm going to win. And I usually do.
Her goal? To get insurers to cover her pregnant patient's addiction medicine. She slips on a headset. It disappears into her curly white blonde hair.
See, here's the mistake that they make, is they give me their, like, personal contact. Then I have it in my arsenal.
The medicine is called Subutex. And without it, patients will go through withdrawal, possibly deliver early and lose the baby, relapse and expose the baby to infections, or overdose.
Hi, Silvana. My name's Catherine Grimes. I had spoken to you yesterday about a patient, Brianna Rohrig.
With patients, she's Biz. With insurance providers, she's Catherine, her birth name.
Yeah, let me just pull up my...
The supervisor on the phone brings up Brianna's medical history.
Our doctors know what's going on, and are you a physician?
No, I'm not a physician.
Okay.
I just don't know.
Then...
Here's the problem. Even though Indiana Medicaid covers Subutex, insurance plans require paperwork before they'll approve it. The process is called prior authorization. Biz spends a lot of time refaxing information she's already sent, like patients' drug test results, proof they're in therapy. The hounding phone calls ensure these bureaucratic errors get fixed fast.
So I don't understand why any of that took place. I don't know why our pregnant patient was forced to withdraw for 3 days.
In this case, Biz got the approval, but Brianna's insurance plan still sent her a letter denying coverage, and amidst the confusion, Brianna stopped coming to the clinic and got sick from withdrawal.
If Biz wasn't around, I would have been screwed. I would have been without meds still, but she called and called and called and called until it finally went through.
Now 33-year-old Brianna is back on her medication and back at the clinic. She says before Biz, she fought her prior authorization battles alone. Sometimes approval took over a week, sometimes she'd sweat it out, other times she'd relapse.
This is what's so frustrating about it, is their pregnancy, in theory, can be held hostage by these people who are not medical professionals.
there are many ways this can happen. It starts when the woman becomes pregnant. She will likely need a shift from her current medicine to Subutex. That requires a prior authorization. Then the state might switch her to a different insurance plan just for pregnant women. After delivery, she'll need to switch medications again. Also, she might require higher doses, especially in the third trimester. Each dose increase requires a prior authorization.
It's just insane. I mean, it's not like it's some, you know, unusual drug that just a very few, you know, number of people need. It's an epidemic.
Addiction treatment specialists say these roadblocks are a deliberate effort by the insurance industry to limit costs. Last year, New York outlawed prior authorizations for its Medicaid insurance plans, but in many states, patients still jump through hoops. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
Yes, that was a report from Emily Foreman on the issue we're going to be talking about today here on No Limits, which is the challenges that addicted moms face. Again, my guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health, Dr. Pat Clements, also of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, who is Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. Good luck getting all of that on a business card, Laura. we probably ought to put this in some sort of context here and talk about really how large a problem it is, because it's one thing, it's an annoyance or it's a blip if we're talking about, you know, one or two people in the state of Indiana. But my sense is that we're talking about far more than that. So I'll start out by, I think I'll ask Laura, how many people are we dealing with who are in this situation right now?
Hundreds.
Hundreds?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a 15-bed facility currently at Volunteers of America, and right now we're working off a wait list because we have so many referrals in the making. And at last count, it was 142 people waiting for services in just our program alone.
And Dr. Benjamin or Dr. Clements, I ask both of you, is this, as with so many cases involving addiction or anything else, the reported numbers really are only the tip of the iceberg, because this is one of those things so many people work to try to conceal. Dr. Clements, you were not in your head first, so I'll go with you, but I'm going to give Dr. Benjamin a chance to weigh in as well.
I'll defer a little bit to Dr. Benjamin. I can speak from a standpoint of a pediatrician that takes care of babies who are born to moms who've struggled with opiate abuse. You know, I'd say your point is exactly right. You know, when you're talking about your pregnancy, you're talking to your family. You know, if you get diagnosed with, you know, maybe gestational diabetes or something like that, you talk to your family about it. But if you're struggling with an opiate addiction, those are not things you sometimes even share with your significant other. And I sometimes see babies in the hospital that were having those first conversations, and you're just seeing the mom just realizing that, you know, now my baby has to stay in the hospital for longer than I expected. And gosh, now I really need to start talking to my family about this, because that's sometimes when these things come up. And so you're exactly right that it's not the kind of thing that that people will talk about with each other. And there's so much of a stigma associated with it. And that just kind of compounds the problem on itself even further.
So I guess that's my way of saying it's been teed up for you now, Dr. Benjamin, which is, you know, we know that there are hundreds. Laura has made reference to it. You know, 15 people already in treatment, 142 on a waiting list. That doesn't include the ones that you've already served.
Absolutely.
In the course of this year. And that's only the tip of the iceberg, the ones that we happen to know about. What does your gut tell you? How many people are affected by this right now?
Pregnant women?
Yeah.
I would probably say thousands. Mm-hmm.
Thousands here in Indiana or thousands in central Indiana?
In central Indiana.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I prescribe buprenorphine or Subutex for pregnant women, but there are a couple of doctors at other facilities that also prescribe for women. We've developed a consortium where we now communicate to make sure that each facility can kind of handle pregnant women and one facility isn't inundated with them. And because there are other doctors that are now doing this, obstetricians that are now doing this, it's a real problem. We weren't trained to do this. This definitely wasn't, I didn't wake up one day and say, hey, I want to take care of pregnant women that have addiction. It started out of necessity. We started to get women to come to our clinics who were getting care with an addiction provider. And then when they got pregnant, they could no longer get care with that addiction provider for one reason or another. And we know that medication-assisted treatment is the best thing for these patients. So myself and some of my partners got the waiver in order to provide Subutex for these patients, and we've been doing it since. I became faculty at IU in August 1st of 2015, and since then I've cared for at least 300 patients.
Who have been
yes
addicted to opioids.
Yes.
So,
and back to your original
point. So that's about 150 a year, because we're coming up on your two-year anniversary.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's very, very difficult for these women to seek treatment because they are scared of repercussions. Mm. They're scared that DCS may be called. They're scared that their families that they have right now could be affected, as well as the child that they're carrying. They're scared that they could be sent to jail. They're also scared that whoever they go to for care is going to judge them. That's the biggest deterrent, I would think, for most people in getting care, is that they're scared of being judged.
And that's something I do want to dive into, is the social pressure involved and you know, trying to figure out a safe path for people to get the help they need. But I'm going to stay with you on this, Dr. Benjamin. When did you first start to notice that this was a problem, not an isolated incident? I mean,
the day that I moved to Indiana. I'm from Louisiana, and I'd done my residency in Louisiana. Okay. And I maybe cared for two or three women that were on cocaine, crack, and one woman that was on methadone throughout the 4 years of my residency. The first time that I came to labor and delivery here, there was a list of patients on the whiteboard with a statement above it saying, do not prescribe. And I asked, what's that list? And they said, these are patients that we think are seeking. And at that moment, I realized that there's a problem in Indiana, because we never worried about patients that were potentially seeking opiates.
So did your start here occur 2 years ago when you say previous?
Actually, my start here occurred 5 years ago. I did my fellowship here.
Okay, so this is a five-year thing. That
yes.
You know. Okay. Dr. Clements, how far do you go back in the state?
Well, I came to Indiana in 2010 to do my residency training in pediatrics at Riley, and then I did a chief residency at Riley, then joined the faculty in 2014. So, you know, and I think when I joined the faculty, one of my main practice sites is at IU Health West Hospital, which is out in Avon, which is a community hospital. There we take care of both newborn babies and then also babies that have to have an increased level of care needing to go to mm-hmm. the NICU. And I think one of the things that when I first started there at IU Health West, we noticed talking to the other pediatrician colleagues is that, man, we're seeing a lot more of this opiate withdrawal. And, mm-hmm. you know, depending on kind of when people came through residency training, that is not something that a lot of people got a, you know, huge amount of focus in their training about. And so here we are as pediatricians trying to kind of take care of these kids to the best
catch
of our ability.
Yeah, to catch
and yeah, and so we're trying to kind of look at, let's, you know, we need to kind of review the best evidence and the best data out there and kind of come up with some maybe some improved plans for how we manage some of these kids. So Dr. Benjamin's exactly right. It's definitely a challenge. There's not great evidence for great data out there for Indiana about what the exact numbers are. But we do know evidence from the CDC that's been out there is that, you know, this problem is increasing nationwide and definitely in our surrounding states like, you know, Kentucky or Ohio that has a little bit more data. I think we can kind of extrapolate that if we're seeing problems in our neighboring states, we're probably seeing the same levels here in Indiana.
Laura, when did, you know, with your work, when did this wave really start to hit, do you
well,
think?
I've been with Volunteers of America since 2014, and the Fresh Start program opened in August of 2015, and it was already a big problem then. I think talking to my colleagues, what they've noticed is that their really big push started in 2009, is when this epidemic really started to outbreak here in Indiana.
So it's almost a decade long. We're into this. Yeah, I think probably this is going to be a complex subject, and we probably ought to take a step back, which we will do after the break, and talk really about what being an an addict, to have an addiction to opioids or, frankly, anything else, does to the mother, does to the child, and dive into that. We are talking about the problems that addicted moms face here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health, Dr. Pat Clements, also of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the problems that addicted moms face, the challenges before them. We are piggybacking on some detailed reporting from the Side Effects public media team. Should say that they're doing far more stories on this, and that for the next few weeks you're going to be learning far more about this important issue and challenge. My guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health, Dr. Pat Clements, also of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. So we teased this before we went to the break. We probably need to take a step back and talk about why being addicted when you are pregnant might be, and I'm trying to search for non-judgmental terms here because I think that's important, might pose some risks for you, for your child, and that attempting to confront what is a challenge would be a good idea. Dr. Benjamin, I'll start with you.
So the risks for a mom that has opioid use disorder or addiction, as it's commonly known, if it's untreated, they are at risk for having preterm labor and delivery, and babies that are born early have a host of problems. They are at risk of having a baby during the pregnancy that has growth restriction, and sometimes that is an indication for us to need to deliver a baby early. Sometimes these moms have what we call placental abruption, where the placenta separates from the uterine wall early, and that can be a bleeding emergency. Sometimes and most often, moms suffer the consequences of associating with the drug culture. So they can contract hepatitis C, they can contract HIV, and those things we know can affect the pregnancy and the baby as well.
Dr. Clements, what are the challenges that the child faces?
So anytime during pregnancy, if mom has kind of a regular exposure to an opiate type of medicine, be it an illicit substance or a prescribed maintenance medication like Subutex or methadone, the baby, you know, essentially grows kind of dependent and used to having that supply coming in to the baby. So that those drugs will come through the placenta and enter the baby. So once babies are born, you cut the umbilical cord, you're cutting off that supply of that substance to baby. And then depending on how long it takes for that substance to kind of metabolize and leave the body, the baby can start showing signs of withdrawal. And so babies...
What are those signs? I'm sorry to
interrupt. Yeah, and what we call this is something called neonatal abstinence syndrome, yeah, which is really a constellation of symptoms that affect pretty much every organ system of the body. But babies that are withdrawing, these are babies that are very, very fussy, very, very irritable. These are kids that are crying all the time. These are kids that we can't get to fall asleep. These are kids that have fast heart rate, fast metabolic rate. These are kids that are burning through so many calories because of just the general irritable picture that they have that they can't even gain weight after they're born. These are kids that also will have difficulty with feeding. They can have a lot of vomiting. They can have really loose, watery stools. So a pretty challenging kind of head-to-toe picture that babies can face. And babies, when they're withdrawing, the challenge for us as pediatricians, I can't look at a baby after they're born and say, you know, mom was on, you know, X dose of methadone or Subutex, and I can predict this baby is going to withdraw and this baby isn't. There's, I think, still a lot that we don't know about what babies are going to end up having withdrawal and which babies won't. So what our big challenge as pediatricians is always to make sure that we're helping to monitor babies for adequate amount of time if there is that concern that they could possibly have withdrawal. And then if they do start having withdrawal symptoms, to be able to assess them for those signs of withdrawal and potentially start treatment appropriately.
Dr. Clements, are the effects long-lasting? I mean, you know, one of the problems with addiction typically is that once you're an addict, you're always an addict. You have so in some ways, are these children then born with you know, to use cliche, a monkey already on their backs?
Yeah, and I think that some of the interesting questions that I think there are certainly studies that are kind of ongoing to look at those answers. I think, you know, some of the biggest challenges that in terms of long-term side effects of babies that have gone through a withdrawal picture, we just don't exactly know. There's some studies out there that have shown a link between opiate withdrawal and potential cognitive deficits later in life. However, there have been other studies that show that when you control for a lot of the other kind of environmental factors, so you look at the caregiver vocabulary level, mom's educational status, and when you kind of control for all those socioeconomic factors, that these babies don't have different outcomes than unexposed babies. So so some of that literature really suggests that it's not about the opiate withdrawal picture itself, but it's about what we can do to support the mother-baby dyad and support that environment, which I think really kind of speaks to all the great programs that we can have in the community that really help support moms and babies together.
Very well said, Dr. Clements.
We are talking about the challenges that addicted moms face here on No Limits today. We're piggybacking on some fine reporting by the Side Effects Public Media team. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi. I happen to cuddle or rock some of these babies out of hospital just to help the nurses out a little bit because they are kind of fussy and unsettled. But my question is that I'm curious where this epidemic has come from, what has caused it in the last couple of years to, and what's the heart of it?
So
thanks
very much for the call, Margaret.
The epidemic stems back to the 90s when drug companies started to create these pain medications. They had some unscrupulous marketing tactics where they told doctors that these medications were not addictive. These medications were studied only in cancer patients, but they told doctors they should be using them for any type of pain. And then fast forward to the 2000s where you have value-based purchasing and the pain scale. So now nurses have to ask patients regularly. It's considered the fifth vital sign. What's your level of pain? And it has to be treated. If it's not treated, then a doctor could potentially be found to have low patient satisfaction. So we definitely want to treat the pain. Those are the two biggest things, kind of the medical industry itself in releasing pain medications a bit early before they were fully studied and we knew how addictive these substances were. And the kind of our society's predilection with instant gratification. I need my Wi-Fi now. I need my pain to go away now. I need to feel absolutely no pain ever.
Well, on that notion also that, you know, the customer is always right when, you know, the customer in this case may not have gone to med school. So,
and to kind of piggyback
Laura,
off
please.
Of that, so once they started prescribing these pain medications and then were finding their patients coming back, missing their bottles or running out before they were supposed to, they were realizing, hey, we've got people that are addicted to this, and then abruptly ending that prescription. And then you have people who are starting to go through this terrible withdrawal and needing to find a way to supplement that. And so they turn to the streets. And if you're looking at prescription medications on the streets, that's $15 to $50 per pill. And by the time people are seeking treatment, they're at 10 to 50 pills a day.
Yeah.
And so heroin kind of came out as a cheaper alternative with a more intense gratification than the prescription pain medications.
How much of this, and I don't want to go into this area because it not only could consume the rest of our hour, but probably about five or six shows after this, and we still wouldn't have resolved anything. But how much of this has also kind of been a product of what has been the uncertainty in sort of our healthcare system over the past decade or so? And I'm saying this is more anecdotal. I'm diabetic, and I know, you know, my doctor sort of at times has to figure out how she can work her way around the insurance system here, particularly if I have to travel somewhere or do something like that, and, you know, adjust the prescriptions. But then that becomes a thing where suddenly, to deal with the short-term problem, getting past my insurance company, what I need to, you know, to take when I'm on vacation, suddenly I'm getting calls from my pharmacy saying that my next dosage is available at least 2.5-3 weeks before I really need it. You know, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who deals with that. Is some of it the fact that the insurance companies, and I think this was part of Emily Foreman's piece that we listened to at the top of the hour, are at some level also attempting to do the prescribing and doing the driving what should be the medical care decisions rather than simply how do we pay for that care. Dr. Benjamin, you're looking thoughtful, so I'm going with you first.
Well, Biz, actually, in that piece, is a nurse that I work with very closely. And yeah. So I would agree that there are a lot of decisions that are being made by people that aren't medically trained, and that limits our ability to treat our patients appropriately. There is more red tape to get a prescription for Subutex, which is the medication used to treat addiction, then there is red tape to get a prescription for hydrocodone or morphine. Or you can get the drug much easier than you can get the treatment. And I don't understand why that is. My patients should have easier access to the treatment than they do to the drug. I don't know how we can solve that problem. Biz is working hard to solve it every day in our clinic. But I do think that insurance companies, I don't know what their motivation is as far as those things.
And I would just say, I mean, as a pediatrician, I think we always like to think of the concept of the medical home. We always like to think of, you know, patients being able to have a primary care provider, someone who knows them best, who knows the issues that they're going through. And I think when you're looking at issues related to pain, you really do need to take a holistic approach, and you need to be able to think of, you know, not only is there an opioid treatment, and sometimes, you know, opioids are definitely indicated for the degree of pain that a patient has, but you always need to be able to take a step back and make sure that you're, you know, thinking of maximizing your non-opiate pain remedies or thinking of other things. And just, you know, the idea that not all pain is best treated with an opiate. And so I think, you know, whatever we can do to help maximize making sure patients have a primary, you know, care provider that can see them, that can maybe, you know, decrease the amount of time they have to go to urgent cares or emergency departments and see providers that don't know their issues, don't know their history as well, and, you know, potentially not help their care.
Laura, you see this from a different perspective.
Absolutely.
How much of this is really we've got the wrong people making what are basically medical decisions?
I can't speak directly to the medical decision piece, but from a treatment perspective, it's impossible for a pregnant woman to get treatment unless she is involved with the Department of Child Services. And that brings its own stigma about for women seeking treatment, and an uncertainty of what's going to happen to my kids if I do get involved with the Department of Child Services. And so that's what we've seen has been a big barrier for treatment. It's just it's so expensive for those who aren't already involved with DCS.
We are talking about the challenges that mothers who are addicted face. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Track us down on Twitter @WFYI. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can do what Renee has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Renee, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I just have a comment. I am the lucky mother of a 10-month-old boy that my husband and I adopted. His birth mother was addicted to basically every kind of opioid you could think of. And we spent 3.5 weeks with him in the NICU, and we did not leave his side. Not that we didn't trust the nurses, but when my baby cried, I wanted to be there. He is ahead of everything cognitively. He is ahead of all the benchmarks. We did go through the First Steps program when we brought him home. But I know that not all birth mothers can take care of their children. If they can, I think we should support them. But I also think that the word needs to get out that there shouldn't be a stigma on the babies whose birth mothers can't take care of them for whatever reason. My son happened to be the birth mother's third child. All of the children were adopted out. We are in contact with the other birth parents, the other adoptive parents. So my son will know his birth siblings and his birth mother if she ever gets to a point where she wants to do that. She is currently still using. She overdosed the day after she had him. So it's a subject that really touches my heart in a lot of ways, because I thank her every day for the courage for what she did. But if she had made a different choice and wanted to get clean, get help, and parent him, I think we need to have that support in place as well. So that's all I wanted to say, and thank you so much for having this topic
certainly.
Of discussion today.
And thank you for calling in and sharing your story with us. Obviously, we wish you, your husband, and most of all, your baby, the very, very best. Thank you very much.
And God bless your family.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So,
thank you.
A lot to unpackage there, because really we're talking about several different challenges. And Laura, I'll start with you here. Mm-hmm. It's creating that safe space for a mother who might be going through some personal challenges to make a decision that is in the best interest of the child. How do we go about doing that?
I think it just goes to what we've been talking about, decreasing that stigma around it and not treating them differently by what they tell you, and supporting their decisions to seek treatment and to actually move forward with getting help.
Would it help if we... I know this will probably light the phone lines up every time I pose this question in any kind of context. If we decriminalized a lot of this stuff, because it sounds like there's a fear, obviously, about legal consequences. If we could somehow strip that out of the equation, do you think it's more likely that people would come forward and say, yes, I need help. This is not who I want to be, or this is not... I want to spare my child this. Dr. Benjamin?
I definitely think decriminalization would help. Studies have proven that this is no longer considered a moral failure or a crime, but it is now considered a chronic disease, just like diabetes or high blood pressure. And the more that we educate people about that, the more that we'll know, treat this person just like they have any other disease and try to get them help just like you would anyone that has any other disease. And actually, I often have to tell my patients this because they consider themselves addicts. And I have to tell them, you have a disease just like somebody with hypertension, and we have to manage it that same way.
It occurs to me here, are we actually adding to the problem by referring to them as addicts rather than person with an addiction?
Actually, you are correct.
Okay, we probably should reframe this.
So technically, we should call them people that have opioid use disorder.
Okay, opioid use disorder. I'm not sure I can get that in the time frame we've got, but I'll do my best. We are talking about mothers who have opioid use disorder
here
on No Limits. We're piggybacking on reporting from Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health, Dr. Pat Clements of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. I am John Krall. If you want to join this conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on social media, or call us at 866-476-3881. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about the problems that mothers with, opioid disorder? Opioid use disorder face here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Tara Benjamin of IU Health, Dr. Pat Clements, also of IU Health, and Laura Hollowell, Assistant Director of Clinical Services for Volunteers of America and its Fresh Start Recovery Program. I've gotten an email from a listener named Cole, and if you want to join this conversation via email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Cole writes, without getting into physical addiction, which symptoms can be treated adequately, I think it's time to reframe psychological addiction. Everyone needs a reason to wake up in the morning. Some people have exercise, others relationships. Sometimes it's drug use. In some people, the only thing they can find to make it through the day are drugs. But it does not have to be like that. We need to provide other so-called addictions for those dependent on drugs. Maybe for mothers, it's starting a cultural program in high addiction areas for mothers to provide an outlet for them that is not drug use. Dr. Benjamin.
I agree with him to a certain extent. A lot of these, a lot of people with substance use disorders, yes, there is a certain level of a psychological addiction, but when you expose them to trauma early in their lives, when you also find that they have other mental health disorders, that makes it very difficult to treat their addiction. You have to treat all of those conditions in order to treat the addiction well. Those things also make them more susceptible to addiction than other people would be. It's a combination of genetics, environment, and personal habits. And it just might be that, you know, you were born on the wrong side of the tracks to parents who used, and so that was your environment, and that's also your genetics now, and you were abused as a child. You ended up with depression or bipolar disorder, and the minute a friend offers you marijuana, you're now addicted. That doesn't happen to everybody. So if we could fix those other parts of the puzzle, then yes, it would be easy to fix the psychological addiction, but it's much more difficult than that. Probably about at least 90% of my patients have had some type of trauma, either sexual or physical. And that is very difficult to manage because the only thing that can fix it is therapy. And many of these women haven't had therapy for those things.
Laura, I noticed you nodding your head fairly emphatically during part of that. You have something, you know, what sorts of intervention are we talking about that are helpful to these mothers?
Yeah, so I agree with Dr. Benjamin. Something that our program specifically tries to do is have a holistic approach to this treatment because we can't just treat the addiction issue. When you have co-occurring mental health issues going on, you have family issues happening, you have no parenting skills or limited parenting skills, you have no life skills generally. Some of our women have not had to own their own home or their own apartment and don't know how to even start doing that. So I think having a holistic outlook on this treatment process is a great place to start, and start with families. It's a family issue.
Dr. Clements, I saw you wanted to jump in, too, before I threw it to Dr.
Just going to, you know, just kind of tag along what Dr. Benjamin was saying, that, you know, when you think of the environment versus genetics, there's more and more, you know, from the field of what they call epigenetics, more and more information that just kind of talks about how the environment might actually change our genetics. So, you know, there's certain studies and things that we hear about occasionally about, you know, different receptors in our brain for how our body interacts with opioids and how some changes with the opioid receptor might make it more likely that some people can succumb to opioid addiction. If they're exposed to opioids at a small amount, that for them it can be much more likely to lead to addiction. And so I think there's a lot of interesting kind of biomedical research that might eventually kind of help to really show that nature versus nurture, they're not quite as separate as we think.
We've gotten a comment via Facebook, and if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. This says, I'm surprised nobody from the Indiana State Board of Health was here on the show. Hopefully you had them already or will have them in the near future. Actually, we often have had guests from the State Board of Health. I would emphasize a couple of things here. One, this show is designed to be a continuing conversation. which means that, not to disparage the wonderful guests I have here in the studio with me right now, but we're not expecting them to solve every problem that we face in terms of dealing with this. It is going to be an ongoing discussion in which many other people will take part, as with a problem of this size is probably appropriate. The second thing is that you definitely should monitor the ongoing side effects coverage, which rolls out most often on Wednesdays, because there's going to be discussion in a lot of different areas with this issue. And speaking of the discussion, if you want to join it, you can do what a listener named Meredith has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Meredith, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
United States has one of the highest rates of cesarean section for birthing mothers. Have there been any studies or statistics that address that issue and its role in opioid use disorder in mothers? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Great. Thanks very much for the call.
Very good question. Actually, this month's edition, the July 2017 edition of Obstetrics and Gynecology, has several studies published, as well as an executive summary from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology summarizing that exact topic. Two of the studies looked at rates of pain pill prescriptions after delivery. And as she said, the caller said, we know that cesarean section is the most commonly performed procedure in the nation. And so that is an intervention that we could approach in order to decrease those that are exposed to opioids. And they looked, those studies found that most women are prescribed too many opioids and most women don't return the unused opioids. They looked at, they aren't the best studies in the world, but they did the best that they could do. Mm-hmm. And so We're just starting to find these things out, and now that we've proven these things, hopefully we can take some measures in order to address them.
Dr. Clements.
I would defer to Dr. Benjamin more. It sounds like there's some interesting data that's emerging on that question. But I think in general, as physicians, we should always look at, how we prescribe opiates and make sure that we're helping to maximize, non-opiate therapies as best as we can.
We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named John, and again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. John writes, did I just hear someone say that marijuana is addictive? The National Institute on Drug Abuse did two studies on it, and both determined that marijuana is less addictive than caffeine.
Let me correct myself. It's a gateway drug. Mm-hmm. So if someone who has a susceptibility to becoming addicted, if they try marijuana and then the door is opened for them to try stronger drugs, they're more likely to become addicted than other people.
Well, also, okay. Cannabis use disorder is a diagnosis in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, 5th edition, which is what psychiatrists and psychologists and other therapists are using to diagnose people. It is in there. It exists. If you cannot cope with your day without using cannabis,
You're addicted to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's.
Although I guess the distinction here, and I think one of our other listeners made the distinction between physical addiction and psychological. Are we talking about that difference here?
We can be. You won't have an intense withdrawal with marijuana like you would with an opiate or a methamphetamine or other type of stimulant. It's probably much more psychologically dependent than physiologically dependent.
So we're getting close on time. We're running up toward the end of the show. I want to leave people with some hope here because this is a pretty bleak subject. What are some concrete things we could do to help these mothers, help their children, help the people that are around them and care about what is happening to them? Laura, I'll start with you first.
I think in a treatment aspect, it's supporting the people who are ready to get treatment and want to get treatment. I think on a bigger scale, having more funding sources for treatment, especially for pregnant women, especially first-time pregnant women who don't have the option to get involved with DCS, And then also volunteering can be a huge help.
When you say support, what do you mean by that? Because that's one of those words right. We toss out and everybody thinks, oh, yeah, I'm supportive. I gave him a pat on the back and then walked away. But what do you mean by support?
Be willing to link with resources. There's Connect to Help, which is a great resource for anyone. But just mainly not stigmatizing, not shutting someone down or giving them crap for telling you.
Okay. Dr. Clements.
I think, you know, a big new area of research that's really is coming out in terms of how we're supporting moms and babies, first of all, really involving parents in the treatment process with babies. So there's a lot of emerging evidence that, you know, parents who can stay with their babies sometimes in the hospital, frequently holding them, swaddling them, breastfeeding, skin-to-skin care, those can really have an impact just on babies' withdrawal, decrease the amount of time they have to stay in the hospital, decrease the amount of opiates that are needed to control baby's symptoms. So really involving parents right off the bat in the care for their baby. And I think as we're alluding to, really just helping to make sure we're setting up those families going home from the hospital with the best support we can. We want to make sure that the parents have all the resources and all the education they need to take care of a baby, from feeding a baby, changing diapers, but to making sure they know what to watch out for, reason mm-hmm. to call their doctor, know how to make sure their baby's sleeping safely. And then getting other resources out there, like the Healthy Families Program that helps to really just help empower new parents. Or First Steps, which does our developmental therapies, helping to make sure babies are reaching their developmental milestones. So I think really just kind of taking it from a holistic team approach, making sure that both mom and baby have all the support they need going home, because that's what we know is going to be linked to long-term success.
I'm going to stay with you for a second, because you're talking about dealing with babies. My children are older now, but
sure.
I can remember when we first brought my daughter and then my son home from the hospital. That's obviously a delightful time, but also an anxious one, because
yeah.
you're terrified. Oh God, what if I do something wrong or da da da? You know, the child's crying. I would think that stress is even greater if you know you've got this other X factor that's built into
it. Sure, absolutely. So just think of, you know, you're sleep deprived, you're worrying about baby, and you know, think of the potential compounding effects if you're a mom that is, you know, maybe having feelings of anxiety or guilt of seeing your baby going through a withdrawal type picture, if you have an ongoing use disorder. So you might be having symptoms yourself. And so, you know, thinking of things that are really common after pregnancy, postpartum anxiety, depression, baby blues, whatever you want to call it, that is definitely an at-risk period, you know, right when a baby comes home from the hospital, like any major transition in life is. So making sure that we're really following these patients, both mom and baby, closely to help make sure that we're covering any needs that come up.
Dr. Benjamin.
So 3 points. I'm glad Dr. Clemens brought that point up. The postpartum period, or what we're starting to call the fourth trimester, is very key to the treatment of these patients. I can only write Subutex for them for a certain amount of time, and I usually do for 8 weeks after they deliver. That means they need to transition to another provider in order to get their Subutex. And like Dr. Clemens said, they often have other psychiatric disorders that need to be cared for. They're stressed out, they're hormonal, they're tired. We really need to make sure that we support them as much as possible. So one thing that can be done is providers or patients themselves should see their providers more frequently in the postpartum period than they normally do. The second thing I'd like to say is that I think most of us listening probably have a bottle in our medicine cabinet that has some narcotics in it. I know I do. And I think that we should all make an effort to get rid of them. You can Google how to get rid of extra medications.
Yeah,
don't flush them down the toilet.
We don't need addicted fish.
Right.
Or whatever.
There are certain drop-off areas where you can dispose of them, because I think getting rid of all of these extra narcotics floating around will help to prevent people from using them. And then the third thing would be, I would hope that we would support any efforts to increase the workforce of addiction providers in Indiana. If there's any legislation out there, talk to your senators and representatives. We really need to increase the workforce in order to treat all of the patients that are addicted out there.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I noticed Laura's body language, she's almost leaning across the table to get into the conversation. Yeah, I think you want to add an emphatic amen there.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen to that. Because we're seeing the people in that postpartum period. They're coming through our program because that's when a DCS case has been opened on a mother. And so they're getting into residential treatment. And we are, like I said, only a 15-bed facility right now. We're hoping to expand pretty soon, but we're one of a kind of program. A mom can bring kids and have their number one motivator right there in front of them.
What happens to the, you know, when you say you've got a waiting list of 147, realistically, because it's not like pregnancy is an open-ended thing, that it just lasts forever, there's a tight window to get them in there and help them. I mean, how many of those 147 are you going to be able to get to realistically?
So priority on our wait list goes to pregnant moms, those who are bringing children with them to our treatment facility. So they don't have to be pregnant to come to our facility. Mm-hmm. And then women who are incarcerated, and then single moms who are in a safer living environment are kind of lower on the list. So we try to give priority to those who have that triaged emergent need. So again, pregnancy and opiate use disorder would definitely be one of those.
Is that one of the frustrations, Dr. Benjamin and Dr. Clements? We've only got about 90 seconds left, but I would think, you know, you both became doctors because you wanted to help people. You know, it sounds like one of the subtexts here is that you can deal with kind of the medical problem, but the other stuff, there isn't necessarily a support system or a safety net out there for them. Dr. Benjamin?
Are you talking about the other stuff that comes with the patient?
Yeah, the frustration of not being, because we've talked about this in very holistic terms, but yeah, often we can't deal with it holistically.
You're correct. Not having the support services that we need is huge. Sometimes I say that our clinic is running on glue, scissors, tape, and liquid paper because we are trying to provide patients with what they need with the resources that we have available. We've just gotten a social worker. We're working on getting somebody in behavioral health, and we're working on getting somebody that can help them with trauma and therapy, things like that. So that is frustrating, but I will say that this is very gratifying work. When a mom has a baby and she has been clean for months, it is so satisfying. And I feel like I've really contributed to humanity.
I can tell you're really fighting tears right now as you're talking. So I want to thank the three of you for what has been an enlightening conversation. Ask all three of you if you wouldn't mind continuing the conversation on our Facebook page. Apparently there's a lot of discussion going on there even while we're on the air. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Tara Benjamin, Dr. Pat Clements, and Laura Hollowell for what has been a fabulous conversation. And I'd like to thank all of our listeners, the smartest audience in radio, for some great questions and comments. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.